Welcome, everybody. My name is Professor Chris Alden. I'm the director of LSE Ideas, and also I hold a post in the Department of International Relations here at the LSE. Today is we're going to be talking about the role of foreign African nationals and xenophobia in South Africa. It's part of our series that broadly examines questions of race and racism, rather, in international politics, discrimination, and other features. I'm very pleased to welcome four distinguished speakers. First and foremost, Dr. Christopher Changwe Nshimbi, who's director of the Center for the Study of Global Governance at the University of Pretoria, and as well as a senior lecturer in the Department of Political Sciences at the university. His research focuses on migration, borders, regional integration, the informal economy, and forms of governance there. He will speak first, present his paper and work. He will be followed by Dr. Kwashi Van Yoro, who is a research fellow at the African Center of Migration and Society at the University of Witwatersrand. His research focuses on migration, temporality, borders, humanitarianism, and governance in Southern Africa. He will then be followed by Dr. Nedson Papiwe, a research fellow at the Center for Learning on Evaluation and Results, also at Wits University. He's a former research fellow at the HSRC, the Human Sciences Research Council, and Democracy, Governance, and Service Delivery, and has been involved in numerous academic policy-focused research projects within South Africa and the region. And then finally, Dr. Sue Onso will speak. She's a senior research fellow at the Institute for Commonwealth Studies and at King's College, and formerly deputy director of the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, as well as teaching here at the LSE. We worked together on the Africa program some time ago. she's produced extensive publications on Southern Africa and Cold War studies. Her most recent publications with Martin Platt was a biography of Robert Mugabe. So if I can ask Dr. Nshimbi to take the floor, or the virtual floor in this case, and speak on his themes today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Prof. Alden, for the kind introduction. My name is Chris Nshimbi, as introduced. I'm at the University of Pretoria in the Center for the Study of Governance Innovation. I'm going to speak about broadly, just to open the discussion for today, about the notion of xenophobia and foreign nationals in South Africa. And then when I feel I've spoken enough, I'll stop so that I let the colleagues also pick up from where I'm going to leave. So I'm basically just trying to throw some dust so that we can start a discussion. And the first point I would make in my discussion is when you look back at 2008 in South Africa, that year seems to have been the epitome of the most extreme violent aggressions and hostility against foreign nationals. And I would also include internal migrants in South Africa. That incident left over 60 people dead, and a lot of other people were injured, besides damage to property in the country. There have been some subsequent recorded major episodes which have occurred since then. For example, there was one again in 2013, there was another one in 2015, there was another one in 2019. But if you look at information that is obtained from, for example, the UNHCR, the Human Rights Commission, or the Lawyers for Human Rights, or indeed any other organization that works on issues that relate to or are in, you know, operate in the interest of migrants and refugees and asylum seekers, you see that from that data, there's a suggestion that incidences of violence and aggression and hostility towards foreign nationals are actually a regular and a near daily occurrence in various locations of the country. So that in fact, if I were to approach the understanding of these incidences from a peace or conflict or transitional justice perspective, then we could view the violence and aggression and hostilities towards the foreign nationals and internal migrants as a lived experience and not episodic occurrences. So they live in that condition or in those conditions, and it's not something that just happens today and then you have some quiet and after 3 days it happens again. You will find that some literature actually suggests, however, that South African nationals ordinarily dwell in convivial relationships with foreign African nationals in local communities in the country. So the argument here is that what is recorded as incidences of xenophobia are rather the exception and not the norm, but convivial relations are actually the norm and not the exception. This view actually echoes the argument that South African nationals are not xenophobic, and the violence and hostilities or aggression that is labeled as xenophobia is rather acts of criminality. And at the very worst, it's a manifestation of what is known as Afrophobia. So it's not xenophobia. And even the government in the country actually holds on to this view that it's criminality and also it's cases of Afrophobia, African fearing fellow African, and not xenophobia. So this view, to me, seems to be informed by a research that was conducted in 2008 by the Human Sciences Research Council, which cited deprivation and concluded that the reason behind the violence against foreign nationals was that poor Black people competed for jobs, they competed for housing and social services with foreign nationals. So it was really, according to the study, it was really deprivation and not xenophobia. So the study actually identified two patterns of the violence against foreign nationals in the country. The first pattern suggested that the violence tended to be targeted at foreign nationals from other African countries and not foreign nationals in general. Then the second pattern showed that the violence tended to be confined to urban informal settlements in the country's major urban centers. And of course, the study zeroes in on, and I'm quoting here, the legacy of apartheid, which has deprived older male respondents of opportunities to acquire skills, was strongly articulated as having placed local residents at a severe disadvantage vis-a-vis foreign nationals, end of quote. And the study actually goes on to now cite a respondent who said that, and I quote the respondent, now we have the new government, but they never consider the fact that we were deprived the chance to acquire skills. The government must design the program to give us skills so that if I get 100 rands, I can make it a million tomorrow. Instead, foreigners come in with their skills. They took our jobs and our business. A foreign man can come and tell you that you are stupid. You don't know how to use money. How would you feel? End of quote. So that was a quotation in the study, citing a respondent in the study. So I must note here that this study was motivated again by the 2008 xenophobic attacks on foreign nationals. And in fact, It was a commissioned rapid response study, which was conducted over a period of 2 weeks and was intended to investigate the underlying causes of the outbreak of xenophobic violence. And here I underscore commissioned and also 2 weeks. And if I remember, I'll come back to those issues that I've underscored. But the point that I want to make quickly also is that the vast majority of research on migration and its related challenges, such as xenophobia, that focuses on South Africa, generally investigates the incidence of migration in the post-1994 era. So this gives the impression and assumption that migration to South Africa only started or significantly increased in, or rather after 1994. I somewhat dispute that, and for me that should be able to explain the reason why you have these tendencies to be aggressive or to be violent towards the foreign nationals if you go beyond or before post 1994. So if you just look at the legacy, normally legacies, you look at present to future, you don't look at the history. Okay, so this tendency leads to the conclusion that the increase in migration is the reason behind the hostility, the aggression, and the spate of xenophobic attacks on foreign nationals. So in other words, foreign nationals come in to take available opportunities, they take jobs, they take houses, they consume services which are meant for South African nationals. What seems to be prominent in this contention is that structural, contextual, and political factors trigger xenophobic tendencies, which is to say that poor living conditions and life opportunities lead South African nationals to or into disliking and attacking foreign nationals. So from the perspective of South African nationals, if you like, this marks of stolen aspirations in a post-apartheid era. So you will find actually even in terms of theorization or theorizing attempts to explain xenophobia, you have, for example, the scapegoating hypothesis of xenophobia, which argues that in the face of transition and expectations of socioeconomic progress, previously disadvantaged groups in the country are confronted with the reality of limited resources and the difficulties of accessing socioeconomic services in a struggling economy. And this is what leads to suspicions that foreign nationals come to steal jobs, opportunities, and even you will find that there's a assertion that or allegation that they even come to steal wives from South African nationals. So the foreign national, including the refugees, asylums, seekers and migrants, especially in informal settlements where they live alongside previously disadvantaged South African nationals, become a ready scapegoat for the unexpected poor socioeconomic realities or those eventualities. So the foreign nationals receive the blame for the poor socioeconomic conditions which prevail in the country. There is also what is known as the isolation hypothesis, which basically holds apartheid responsible for xenophobic attacks on foreign nationals. According to this theory, South African nationals fear and mistrust foreign nationals because of the international seclusion of South Africa during the apartheid era. So the seclusion coupled with a general lack of knowledge and understanding among South African nationals of conditions in the countries from which the foreign nationals originate leads them to mistrust the foreign nationals. And so the isolation of South Africa in a way because of apartheid is said to have turned the nationals into inhospitable people. And this is what makes them attack foreign nationals. Thirdly, there's a biocultural hypothesis, which basically says South African nationals are not xenophobic towards all foreign nationals. They are rather, or they rather direct their violence and hostility towards fellow Blacks of foreign origin. But these fellow Blacks look visibly different in terms of physical appearance from South African nationals. So the skin color, for example, or the speech of the foreign nationals are said to be very distinctly different from those of South African nationals. And this is why they are feared. This is why they are disliked or hated or subjected to aggression by the nationals. So these views that I've presented, while they acknowledge the influence of racially based inequality, they emphasize competition for limited resources, and that this therefore actually explains the violent episodes that are branded as xenophobia. What this implies is that besides being acts of criminality, the violence or the hostility and the aggression towards foreign nationals is nothing more than a struggle for limited resources, which is occasioned by inequality. So this interpretation actually raises the stakes in attempts to define xenophobia, and it actually makes it very difficult to define xenophobia. And the point that I'm trying to make here is that while acknowledging racial inequality and the consequent violence, hostility, and aggression towards foreign nationals, what these views fail to do is to make a link between the racialized inequalities that they acknowledge and the violence or the hostility and the aggression towards foreign nationals. So for me, this brings me to a point where there's a necessity or a need to really define xenophobia. What do we mean when we say there's xenophobia in South Africa, or indeed across the African continent and even in the world? I'm tempted to leave it there and not so much go into the definition of xenophobia, but basically, in trying to conceptualize xenophobia, I, for one, would side with the conceptualization that is given by Gross Fogel also and Christou, who basically provide an alternative understanding of racism, which differs from those discourses which seem to have transformed from biological to cultural racist dialogue, and actually they deny their own racism. So these three authors show that a relationship exists between racism and issues of intersectionality, and in turn they relate this to migration theory. So the alternative understanding of racism and this relationship to intersectionality, which they present, has implication for racism. And for them, racism is a global hierarchy of humans which was instituted by the capitalist or patriarchal Western-centered modern world system. And so you have a hierarchy of individuals and of people in terms of basically skin color, but it goes beyond skin color. So because generally when you talk about racism, the general understanding is that it's based on skin color, but skin color is certainly not the sole marker of racism. So specific social practices that depend on colonial histories exist in various parts of the world where racism is accordingly variously marked. So racism may be a basis upon which people in those parts of the world are hierarchized into inferior or superior groups. And what is worth emphasizing here is that ethnic, cultural, religious, and linguistic markers can respectively also be used to classify and establish a hierarchy of human beings into superior and inferior, apart from skin color. So that's where I bring in. So if you say you are differentiating, or maybe let me just quote from these authors, where they say that racialization occurs through the marking of bodies. So that if you talk about foreign nationals coming into another country, and this is not limited to South Africa, if you talk about foreign nationals going into another country, the marking is not made on the basis of just color, but it's on their bodies. And that would be the distinguishing mark, which now will make those people to be subjected to attacks or aggression and things of the sort. And in relation to South Africa, I would contextualize it within the broader Southern, Eastern and Southern African region. And here, for me, that's why I said that I go beyond post-2024, but rather I go back to the history of the region, where you talk about, especially with regards to labor migration, the fact that the Southern and Eastern African region has a very long history of migration, and some of the trends in those in that history of migration, which I can point to, and I'm heading towards the end of what I wanted to say, is that there are economic centers that were established by the colonialists and entrepreneurs who came from the West. For example, we can talk about South Africa itself, the gold mining and the diamond mining in Witwatersrand and Kimberley and everywhere. But also you have countries like Botswana, where there was diamond that was mined there. You have countries like Zambia and the copper center. You had Zimbabwe, and also the agricultural center there. But the point here being made is that in the process of establishing those centers, the entrepreneurs, so those that were enterprising alongside or operating together with the colonial governments, needed labor, for example. So they made up systems where they would ensure the supply of labor from the entire region. But by bringing foreign labor, they also, in the process, if we take in now the argument of Grosfogel to say there's this hierarchization of human beings, in the process, they would pit African against African. And so that basically would be the source or the origin of these hostilities that you find one African being hostile against another African. I think I'll pause there and then leave other colleagues to pick it up from there. Thank you so much for listening.
Great. Thank you very much, Chris. It was fantastically broad and yet detailed as well. So I think you've set the scene and you've provided us with a lot of material which to think about the topic. It's now, if I could turn to Dr. Kuda Kwashe Vanyoro, if you Kuda Kwashe, if you could pick up and from there and give us your perspective.
Thanks a lot, Prof. Chris Alden, and thanks a lot, Prof. Chris Nshembi, for the presentation. I really think that this is an important conversation, and I'm really glad that we could make time to kind of have this sort of an engagement. And I do like where Chris Nshembi has taken or is taking the discussion, because I also sort of try to take a perspective that also is sort of cognizant of the connections between international migration and sort of internal migration, or maybe broadly speaking, talking perhaps of mobility. And also, I think this idea of embodied corporal experience is important in our understanding, particularly as Chris has already mentioned, in a context where xenophobia and intolerance are a widespread and growing concern and have sort of remained an issue in South Africa repeatedly since 94. And I do like this idea that this should not necessarily be seen as mainly a question of episodic occurrences. It is part and parcel of people's everyday realities. And in this regard, I'm going to talk more from the angle of sort of public health as a sort of case that I have looked into to try maybe to also echo and perhaps generate some kind of a discussion around some of the issues that Chris has already mentioned. So one of the things we know from some of the scholarship that exists is that xenophobia is mainly targeted at African migrants, but some categories experience it differently. For example, Nigerians may be more criminalized in popular discourses than others for selling drugs and running brothels, all perpetually, of course. We do find arguments that argue, for example, that conflating xenophobia with racism does not capture the South African situation, where anti-foreigner sentiments among Africans primarily target other Africans. But I think it is important, maybe drawing on your Cosmos work, to see how xenophobia is a form of discrimination closely related to racism, since foreign status, as he would argue, is declared on the basis of the crudest racist stereotypes. But at the same time, this should not be a way to undermine racism in itself, because of it also has its own attributes, ideologies, and characteristics that might be different altogether. But this should only be used to highlight how xenophobia can affect anyone or any group that is considered non-Indigenous or non-autochthonous. And on that basis, one of the kind of key actors in sustaining xenophobia are state institutions. So we're not simply restricted to talking about xenophobia as physical violence. We should also allow ourselves to talk about it as institutionalized or structural. And for example, we see in 2008, the South African Police Service response to the violence in protecting victims being criticized for being ambivalent and leaving a lot to be desired. That's a scholarship by scholars such as Poza and Takavira. So in my sort of conception, or at least the way I try to understand the occurrence of this kind of violence, I think we need to perhaps move beyond perhaps only seeing violence practiced by bodies or actions of poor individuals, to look at how it is manifested in certain practices through the exclusion and discrimination of foreigners in certain institutions like banks, home affairs, the police, and other social service providers. And this is located in what Chris was mentioning about the history and expectations of reaping fruits of the fruits of democracy, and public health has become one of those issues that are politicized and also institutionalized in the practices of frontline workers in terms of how they tend to perceive migrants. And scholars such as Crash and Tawadzera have argued that in the absence of official directives to the contrary, of sort of saying healthcare workers should not act as enforcers and immigration controllers, they still have the power to withhold services, and they can certainly influence the way that those services are delivered. And in the area of public health, again, we know that migrants have difficulty in accessing services if they're undocumented or speak different languages. And there's a body of scholarship documenting these experiences. So in this brief remark, I would like to highlight some of the ambiguities of the exclusionary nature of this frontline discretion that often sometimes mislead us into an oversimplification that may be detrimental to our efforts to advocate for the over-inclusion of migrants, asylum seekers, and refugees. And this is a concern echoed by colleagues such as Kihato and Landau, 2016, who argue that international and national obligations to protect refugees in contexts where local populations are themselves vulnerable and poor only breed resentment and hostilities from local populations and political backlash from leaders with local voting constituencies. So I would argue, again, going back to Chris's initial provocation about sort of internal migration, looking at internal migration and looking at experiences, that we should also be careful of sort of falling into the trap of methodological nationalism in terms of how we define and conceptualize migrants. And this speaks to sort of focusing exclusively on individual national samples, or using the nation state as the sole unit of analysis, because this may also leave us with little to work with in terms of understanding the perspectives of people who are on the front line and also the perspectives and heterogeneity of these perspectives and experiences and practices, and how they are affected and influenced by different structures and spaces. And I think the same would apply for the experiences as well of internal migrants. And there are also times when static conceptions of citizenship, nationality, or legal status do not appear to tell us much in terms of how migrants experience the country differently. We know that difference and outsiders are subjectively and socially constructed and negotiated. Hence, xenophobia may also transcend nationality, cutting across different temporal social constructions of whose body the community perceives as an outsider. And I think this echoes what Chris was talking about, the focusing on the marker, the body as a marker. And recognize this allows us also to read the centrality of the body or the individual as a site for the negotiating of belonging. And what other scholars have, such as Nguyen, have called stateless citizenship, particularly within medical systems. Also under what conditions this may occur would be important to know as well. And while it may be true that undocumented migrants have a hard time and they are afraid to access health services in South African healthcare institutions, it would also be a mistake to infer that ethnic, racial, or nationality contingencies or appeals always prevail in affecting these discretionary judgments of healthcare providers or any frontline worker, for that matter, because these workers may treat migrants in the public healthcare system through various rationales of moral deservingness that is mediated by the body, which may lead us to start to see certain aspects of bureaucratic incorporation. And this is something we might find or we find happening in border areas, for example, where migrants sort of assume de facto legitimacy to be part of a particular community based on sort of localized conceptions of inhabitants or residents. So in the particular case of the Zimbabwe-South Africa border, for example, Zimbabwean migrants may experience providers who use date of birth to identify and keep a record of undocumented migrant patients to replace the 13-digit South African identity number. It's also, we also see this this interaction in the work of Siziba, who's worked on Zimbabwean migrants in different neighborhoods of Johannesburg, where conceptions of local inhabitants may be mediated by identity aspects such as language. And language may come to act as an entry fee, as you would call it, in which the enoughness and authenticity of his speaker can be evaluated through a sort of avenue of incorporation. We may also find healthcare providers themselves interacting with migrant patients who speak different languages, putting an effort to connect with them through informal interpreters or asking coworkers or patients fluent in their native languages to translate in English or other native languages. And this is there is also emerging research that is beginning to explore these variations across gender, migratory, and levels of care, or several other intersectional identities. And finally, the other way that such incorporation may take place is through discourses of moral deservingness, in which healthcare providers use notions of morality, ethics, and public service to frame their decision-making. But we see this particularly when it comes to specific diseases that sort of bring to the rise different politics. For example, HIV treatment is one example in which healthcare providers would assist migrant patients without referral letters, depending on how they profess their sort of belonging through alternative forms of knowledge and expertise. In one case, a nurse claimed that she only provided antiretroviral therapy if migrant patients demonstrated knowledge of their medication or if they brought a medicine container for a refill. In Johannesburg, one also finds what they call adherence groups, which are for clinically stable patients. So this is one of the ways in which what Nguyen calls therapeutic citizenship, in which people start to make claims on the basis of a biopolitical condition. and healthcare workers may frame that responsibility around sort of shared goals and universally accepted principles, such as those set by the United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, to have 90% children screened, 90% in treatment, and 90% viral suppression by 2020. More recently, one can even be as ambitious to suggest that ongoing calls against what my colleague, Professor Vary, calls at the center calls vaccine nationalism, and also which is also a call that the South African president has also taken on, present an opportunity for these kinds of biomedicalized framings that sort of seek to sort of transcend nationality. So it's granted, though, that some of these processes of sort of creaming may exclude others who are defaulters or clinically unstable patients who are deemed unworthy under criterion of responsibility, but it animates the possibility for some migrants to appropriate different forms of stateless citizenship, whereby they can make claims on the basis of particular biomedical conditions. Perhaps I would argue in concluding, pushing the debate beyond autochthony and citizenship will also allow us to identify opportunities where informal, inclusive, and innovative practices, convivial, if you would like to call it that, to go back to Chris's terminology, are already taking place on the front line, in spite of what policy or political directives that might be xenophobic or discriminatory or racist might even say. So I will end it at that. Thank you.
Super. Thanks, Kuta Kwashi. It's appropriate to talk about public health in the era that we are in, the era of the pandemic as well. So there'll be much, I'm sure, to follow up on that. If I could ask Dr. Nedson Papiwa, please, to speak. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. Just let me know if my sound is clear enough on your side. All right. Thank you. And thanks to my predecessor presenters. I think they did set the tone quite very well. I just wanted to speak about most likely some of the points that have already been raised. So there'll be some duplication in some areas, but a little bit more emphasis on issues that I feel that could also have been amplified. And I want to start off with, and not necessarily even speak about the definition of xenophobia, but rather the rejection of the word xenophobia in the public, at least in the public sector or by officials who operate in different sectors within the country. I want to start off by a personal experience as having been a researcher in 2014 working on the review of the 2002 Immigration Act. And when we were invited to present our findings to the then Minister of Home Affairs, Naledi Pandor, who only had a short stint in the ministry. One of the things that happened was that at the end of our presentation in the question and answer section, she made a very remarkable comment, and I had been the one who had made the presentation. And she took me back to a slide where I had actually used the word xenophobia. And for her, she challenged that particular slide and the use of the term and said, look, I do not believe that my people are xenophobic. And she spoke about the fact that she did not believe so because or an attitudinal behavior. And so for her, her argument was that her people could not just be outright xenophobic for no apparent reason. And she then gave an account of how in the late 1980s and in the early 1990s, hotel staff used to be, and restaurant staff used to be South African citizens in her explanation. And so she says, after 1994, how did it so happen that slowly but surely there has been almost a replacement of the same staff that used to serve them in restaurants? And that replacement could be Zimbabweans, could be Congolese, or any other African nationals from different countries from the continent. And that made me ponder a little bit, because she just didn't stop there, but went on to say, I honestly don't agree with what is now the African Center for Migration Studies, ACMS, in the way they express that indeed my people are xenophobic. And she said, it's a pity that my meeting has to end now, but I would like to have more dialogue in future with researchers and really iron out some of these issues. Now, it only took about another 2 weeks before there was a cabinet reshuffle and she moved ministry. But what was interesting is that the report that we tabled to her did not see the light of day, because within 2 weeks after she left office, the new minister announced new regulations, which are an amendment to the Immigration Act. And yet the department is the one that had commissioned us to do a research on the reviewing the immigration policy itself. So it simply meant that whatever we had written did not filter into the Immigration Regulation Amendment of 2014, which then came shortly after we had submitted our report. And that tells you that at the apex level, discussions around the use of the term xenophobia themselves are sort of what I would say there has been a rejection of the term. And the official adoption of the term the phrase violence against foreign nationals has been the more preferred terminology. The government communications department often encourages the use of such a word, violence against foreign nationals, because it opens up to interpretations such as elements of criminality are probably behind a certain episode or a certain widespread incident where violence occurs. Now, that is not the only term that has been rejected over time. I think the use of the word international migrants or migrants also has not even made it to some of the official documentation. You will find it, but not all the times. What you will find is the use of terminology such as foreign nationals. And foreign nationals is the use of terminology such as foreign nationals is also equally interesting, because it is a replacement of what was referred to as aliens in the Aliens Control Act, which was in the pre-1994 era. So substituting aliens by using foreign nationals has become sort of the norm. And that is the more widely accepted terminology. And why do I make reference to this? It is because when you speak about xenophobia, you sort of attach a certain label that then requires that there is something problematic in society, which perhaps even politicians themselves might not know exactly how to address. So the quickest solution is always to send in police who will make some arrests and then quell that violence, and then life continues. But from 2008, a decade later in 2018, you could tell that a decade later after 2008 violence, nothing much had changed. If at all, there was even more confidence in local communities that at any given time, when they feel frustrated, it is very easy to vent out frustrations against migrants or foreign nationals, as they're often made reference to. Another point I would like to bring out is what I would call the rise of immigration enforcement within the non-state actor space. So here we're talking about the practices of maybe landlords or property owners, rental companies, that will specifically demand certain paperwork that migrants are not likely to have, particularly if they're even illegal. And even if they are students with valid visas, they might still not have national identity documents. And I think in some of the work, early work of Professor Landau, one of the things that he had identified was that, considering that there are about 11 official languages in South Africa, and there are about, let's say, equally so, 11 ethnic groups, that would mean that if you were in Johannesburg and you spoke and you're at least of one, coming from one of the ethnic groups, your only identifier or your only identifier of national import or national significance would be your identity document, and not necessarily the fact that you are South African or from the country or born in the country, but rather the fact that you have that identity document. So then that is then put into algorithms, into online applications for, as Kuda has already mentioned, for it could be finance with banks and so on, that the 13-digit identity number becomes your identifier, and that becomes your marker of difference with the others. Now, those who don't have that then become the other. Now, when I say the rise of immigration enforcement by non-state actors, it then manifests itself even in the labor recruitment processes, where sometimes unions might challenge the appointment of a certain, even if it's a professor, there can be a challenge in the university that we would not like that appointment to be done, because we would rather want that position to be changed to become a developmental position, which will look at employing at least a local candidate. Now, my argument is that there really is no, I would not say we can fault some of those practices, but it is just to pick out how some non-state actors have then decided to also police immigration where they feel that it is failing at the state level, and therefore putting that in into other spaces. In some cases, a protest against illegal immigrants then come up in communities. In some cases, you have communities where drugs become a rallying point for a community. And once the word drug is mentioned, then certain nationalities become the target for that particular cleanup. Now, the role of local actors in also settling territorial conflicts or territorial scores in these communities where you find large groups of migrants is also quite critical, because it is sometimes local actors that could be self-appointed community leaders, self-appointed group or maybe gang leaders who have certain vendettas against others or claiming territory by then protecting certain foreign nationals who run business or migrants who run business, and saying, do not attack these ones, but going all full force in attacking, it could be migrant shop owners in the next street. So the complexity of labeling and xenophobia also comes into that space. That is why perhaps the minister during that time challenged me to, on the use of the word xenophobia itself, because it is not as simple to explain as we sometimes, as Chris has already mentioned, we oversimplify in some cases. And why would I bring it so far? I would say an advocate or somebody who is protesting against migrant-owned spaza shops, as they call them, or migrant-owned tuck shops in their community, that he wants them to be owned by locals, can actually be employing a foreign national as a domestic worker in his household. And he could be going to a church where the pastor is also a migrant from another country within the continent. So this is an individual who makes choices about which parts of his life he wants to allow certain foreigners to be his closest, and in which other parts of his livelihood are under threat when foreigners are the ones who are leading in them. So it then becomes very complex, because one person could be equally supportive of certain initiatives, but completely against other initiatives. Hence, the emphasis on attitudes then becomes equally always difficult or fluid when we try to apply it. Now, I also want to take a step back and reflect on ourselves as the scholars who have been writing on migration over the years within the South African context, that there are certain failures within the way we have approached migration research, migration studies, which is not to do with the rigor that we have put into it, but rather the consumption of that literature widely into spaces where it matters the most. Because in those spaces, those are the areas where actors will be able to either bring a change to some of these attitudes that we see, or some of these policies, or some of these practices that we see, which are sometimes anti-immigrant. Now, why would I say so? If you look at it, for the most part, there are very few, or in comparative terms, students who would take up research, yet if they are from host communities, or at least if they are citizens and they are students, who would then take up topics that really look at at foreign nationals or at migration. Now, the upper hand that citizens would have in conducting some of these research projects would be that they could also bring out the perpetrator's voice. And perpetrator's voice here, I would loosely be referring to sometimes those people who actually participate in violence against migrants in their communities. It is not accessible to a migrant researcher from the start to even go into, for example, areas that are of high hostility against immigrants to try and interview the ringleaders or the perpetrators and get that voice. So that voice sometimes remains silenced. Sometimes it is crudely presented by journalists who do go into some of these areas. But articles that have the rigor and the same kind of rigor that articles that have been presented on migration themselves have not cut it into that space. So if the story is only told by migrants about immigration, how will locals begin to understand what happens, for example, at borders? If you look at the border post, I think in 2020 December, one of the most fascinating things was that the border between Zimbabwe and South Africa went to a standstill for days. But each time a local specialist came out on the, or can I say a public commentator or a public intellectual came out on TV as a respondent to maybe to speak on some of these issues, you often were cringing if you are an expert on migration, because it seemed to be as if that all of a sudden there was an avalanche of people wanting to get into South Africa after the festive season. Well, that was actually not the case, because over years, just before 25 December, traffic flow is always at its highest. So because COVID regulations were being enforced, screening and temperature checks, it just made the queues become even much longer for kilometers and kilometers. Yet that trek, or that great trek as it appeared to be on television screens, on international bulletins, was actually something that was not outside of the norm, but rather had been exacerbated, obviously, by the delays that were being channeled through COVID-19 regulations and enforcement. But because I remember as part of my doctoral thesis, I looked at that same period, whereas in some cases, 2,000 people can cross the border, or 2,000 crossings can happen during a given day. At Christmas time, or just before Christmas time, or during the festive season, it can pick up to 26,000 crossings within a 24-hour period. And that is a lot of people moving, buses, trucks, and motor vehicles. So obviously, knowledge of some of these things requires also to filter through. And that is why I'm saying that as long as our scholarship, our writings do not reach the places where they need to really be read and to be understood, it will always be equally so an us and them kind of a scenario. But as I also work towards concluding my presentation or my discussion, where did policy miss the plot? And in an article that I wrote with Bensel and Phil Yun in 2016, one of the things that we looked at was that it was as if 1994, there was a sudden realization that there was a need to revise immigration policy. And revising immigration policy then meant rethinking what had been the target population for migrants. Prior to 1994, the apartheid government had always designed its systems, its recruitment processes to recruit unskilled and semi-skilled labor migrants from the rest of the Southern African region. There were labor recruiters, sometimes even those who would recruit by hook and crook to really deliberately recruit migrants from the region. And yet after 1994, the argument was then that we need skilled migrants. So the critical question we ask in that article is, how do you undo over a century of a practice in which certain parts of the continent in which the immigration policy targets unskilled migrants, and all of a sudden it begins to target skilled migrants? So how do you delete a century and a half of movement. And as I come to a closure, I also want to mention that one of the things that I found working in different sectors within the country is that there are also certain unacknowledged roles of departments of state within South Africa. One of them is the Department of Social Development, which has been running community dialogues at a very low level between migrants and also perpetrator communities, especially in hotspot communities, which have been identified by Freedom House. And seeing social development specialists or social development workers really working with communities to bring dialogue between them and the victims of violence really is encouraging. So sometimes we miss some of those. So the question that I leave as I close is how, despite these brazen forms of violence, attitudes, and xenophobic violence towards African migrants, how is it that African migrants still eke out comparatively decent livelihoods? And in some cases, they also claim place and belonging to South Africa, regardless of all these issues that we are speaking about. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Very, very reflective, and I think self-reflective of the discipline and adding that and the question about the voice too is very interesting, the voice of the perpetrator. So if I can ask Dr. Sue Onslow to join us now.
Colleagues, thank you very much indeed. And my thanks to Professor Alden. I'd like to pick up on some of the points that have been made by the three excellent previous speakers. With Chris making reference to the importance of history and language. I want to talk about, if you like, a different landscape of implicit and explicit violence and antagonism, which has direct implications and also, of course, can have very real life consequences, transcending the territorial space, which is social media. And also Kudu Nkwashi, when he was talking about xenophobia and state institutions, and Nedson's excellent reflective points on political lexicons and how individuals may have their may have internalized or appreciated or not appreciated their question of self-awareness, but also questions of projection. Because I think this all plays out then in use of language on social media. And I just want to highlight briefly, because I know Chris wants to leave enough time for Q&A, some discussion points on the role of social media in either stimulating xenophobia in South Africa, or the extent to which social media also enables important counterpoints to emphasize support for, should we say, non-South African citizens, because of course, international migrants, refugees are not entitled, as I understand it, to citizenship. But that, in other words, communities of practice on social media can cut both ways. But what has been disturbing, I think, and should be highlighted, are developments on social media, particularly in 2020, that have been picked up by the Center for Analytics and Behavioral Change at UCT, and also a data forensic research lab at, I believe that's at FITS, but they have both identified that rather than individual instances of tweets using either both implicit or explicit violence, hate speech, discrimination, antagonism, in a conceptualization of a tweet that's put out there and it would cascade haphazardly through the Twitter sphere, but instead of which there are communities of practice which are being orchestrated through social media to ensure that, express individuals are using hashtags identified with xenophobic, either both implicit or explicit underpinnings. The Put South Africa First hashtag was the most trending Twitter handle in mid-2020 with over 360,000 retweets, and it was reaching at this point over 2 million views. So given the consumption of social media, I think that we as researchers should be looking at different landscapes of where there are contestations and how communities of practice can be fostered, can be augmented, and that these are not necessarily incidental and or haphazard, that they can be deliberate and coordinated. And according to the DFR, the Data for Forensic Research, that this is highly deliberate. They have conducted extensive data mining of Twitter's APIs, going through literally hundreds and hundreds and thousands of tweets, using express hashtags, with focusing particularly on Put South Africa First, and have come to some very, very disturbing conclusions, which rather than Put South Africa First being, shall we say, an affirmation of the value of South Africa and South African businesses, there are extreme elements emerging within it, almost hiding in plain sight, because most of its users are staying below the bar, which Real 411, which is the fact-checking website established by Media Monitoring Africa and the South African Electoral Commission, so that the public can report hate speech, discrimination, and it can be investigated. But instead of which, there are an established community of users who are deliberately orchestrating a community online. Courts Africa identified that the march to the Nigerian and Zimbabwean embassies in Pretoria on the 23rd of September was orchestrated online. And this was the first time that such a, shall we say, a demonstration, rather than more spontaneous, quote, manifestations of violent xenophobia attacks in townships, in informal settlements, but that it had been, as I say, a clear community of practice. Now, of course, social media is also used by migrants, by refugees, as communities of information, communities also of access of information about the refugee reception centers, necessary warnings that can be also permeated through WhatsApp groups. And in 2015, in response to a number of xenophobic attacks, there were a deliberate, shall we say, expression on Twitterscape that South Africa should assert its human rights credentials, going back to the Bill of Rights, to the Progressive Constitution, and that it should be an important offset to a narrative of rising levels of xenophobia and Afrophobia. Now, when I emphasize Twitter, it's of course, there are 2.28 million Twitter users in South Africa. 45% of people over 13 are on Facebook. That's over 20 million people. 4 million people on Instagram. So in terms of consuming news, we really do, as researchers, need to bear in mind that we shouldn't look at legacy mainstream media. Nedson made points about where our research should reach. And we think about policy practitioners, we think about reaching politicians. But I think we need to think about the extent to which social media is the means of consumption for, of course, cross-sections of South African society. It's got over 36.54 million internet users in South Africa, with it's the largest internet consumption across the continent of Africa. And this is likely to increase by 40% by 2023. So I've looked forward, rather than the importance, obviously, of bearing in mind the historical conditioning factors, which are so important to explain of how we are. But I think that in understanding the multiple pressures and multiple vectors and platforms, we do need to think about the ways in which our conceptualization of space and the body is altered by the way in which people consume news, and ideational attitudes are reinforced, either consciously or subconsciously. And that, I think, we need to really bear in mind. Chris, I've kept that very short because I know that you want to have a large section for questions.
Thank you very much. Thanks for keeping to the timing, and yet packing in there quite a punch with that amount of time. Social media.
Deeply concerning.
So this is an opportunity now for questions, and I'd like to start with one that I of course have my own, but I see we're collecting a fair number. So I'd like to bring it to the audience first. And if there's time, I'll ask my own, which is, let's start with a question from Bahati in Nairobi, who asks, and it's not directed at anyone in particular, so I would ask that any of the panelists speak to it who feel that they wish to. The question is, what is the perception of refugees and asylum seekers specifically? Is this competition for scarce opportunities and resources also evident? Is there data on this? So they're framing the question with regard to refugees and asylum seekers and their perceptions of these questions on xenophobia and the relationship to employment and opportunities, scarce resources. I don't know if Chris wants to say anything first, since you came first, or if others want to jump in from there.
Yeah, yes, thank you so much for the question. For me, the question is quite... it's a complex question, particularly because it focuses on asylum seekers and refugees. And the reason I say that is when you look at migration in general in the Southern African region, at least, it's very difficult to put a finger on the type of migrant that is moving. You can only specify after, for example, a person has been awarded refugee status, for example, that they actually are a refugee. But even in those instances, the point I'm basically making is that the migration that occurs in this region is mixed. So you may have a person that enters not only South Africa, by the way, it's across the region. A person who enter, let's say, Congo DR, from Angola as an informal trader. But then the moment they are in Congo DR, they see an employment opportunity, then they become what is known as an economic migrant. So even the tensions would be associated with, as I said earlier, sometimes it would seem that there's a conflict over resources or competition for resources. That is what would determine the perception of the foreign national.
Is it fine if I also respond to that?
Yeah, please. Sorry, I didn't realize I had my mute on there for a second. So yeah, go ahead.
I mean, to that question, we do have some data, sort of some surveys, for example, the Afrobarometer have done some surveys that try to answer some of these questions. I know of one, I think in 2011, obviously there might be some more recent ones, but where in one of the cases they were trying to sort of measure attitudes towards asylum seekers, and for the following statement, they asked people whether they agree or disagree. And the question was sort of, people who are persecuted for political reasons in their own countries deserve protection in South Africa. And more South Africans, that is 44%, disagree with the idea of providing protection to asylum seekers, against the 38% who felt that foreigners who are persecuted in their home countries should be allowed to seek protection. So again, I think as well as Chris has also just hinted, it's also like somewhat like, you know, hot and cold, right? It's like 38%, 44%. And obviously in between, some people not agreeing or disagreeing and some saying they don't know. But when it comes to attitudes towards sort of foreigners in general and employment opportunities, for the statement, foreigners should not be allowed to live in SA because they take jobs and benefits away from South Africans, people were asked to agree or disagree, and 45% of the respondents agreed that foreigners should not be allowed to live in SA because they take jobs, and this leads to competition between them and South Africans, whilst 39% believe that they should be allowed. So this is what sort of the kind of surveys or Afrobarometer stats would tell us, right? But from a more maybe qualitative point of view, we do know that, you know, there is sort of this perception that refugees and asylum seekers do not necessarily, and this is going back to Nelson's point around an immigration regime that measures value using, you know, this notion of low skills and high skills. And there isn't really much of people who are refugees and asylum seekers are not necessarily perceived as sort of beneficial to sort of the country's development. And this is sort of, we see this in how, in some of the framing around, while South Africa is moving towards like a migration and development framework, which is sort of what the Global Compact and all of the global discourse is moving towards, that is an appreciation of skills, they're more biased towards high skilled. So now you see refugees and asylum seekers now, they're going to be losing their right to work and study in the country. And that can only, the inference perhaps can be, that can only because of a perception that they're not necessarily contributing to development, because they are perhaps found in low to informal skilled work, which also the Gauteng Economic Development Bill is trying to come into force to make it illegal for them to work or open businesses in townships, particularly Ethiopian entrepreneurs and Somalian entrepreneurs. So there is that bit of a sort of interaction between perceptions of different categories of migrants. For the high-skilled workers, there is sort of a perception that they must be documented, but it's also, again, not only limited to refugees and asylum seekers, but for those who are undocumented, who are sort of precarious, there is a perception that, I think within this Put South African First movement, there's always some sort of direction towards a particular group of people, and that's people who are undocumented, even though I've seen here and there some xenophobic sort of tweets and adverts going as far as calling for the removal of those who already have documentation, but that is not necessarily sort of the dominant kind of discourse.
Great, thank you very much. We've got another question.
Just quickly. I just want to highlight the work of my colleague Nick Maple. He's just finished his PhD at the Refugee Law Initiative, and he's identified that there's a popular narrative of asylum seekers abusing the system. And this has percolated even through to UNHCR officials working in Johannesburg, which is troubling. But that Nick's picked up in his research on ideas that 90% of asylum seekers do not qualify for asylum status. This is actually stated in an ANC policy document from the Department of Home Affairs from 2016 of a green paper, which the inference is that these are economic migrants or they're criminals, but they've made quote bogus claims. So if that's indicative of, should we say, of particular mindsets within state institutions, that's very troubling.
Very much so. We've got another question from Joshua Matazima in Melbourne. Could the speakers comment on COVID-19 related xenophobia that's occurred in SA, in South Africa in May, June 2020? So if one or two of you could comment on that. Perhaps we should start with Nedson, who hasn't spoken.
Just a clarity-seeking question on that one, Chris, would be that was this xenophobic violence or just xenophobia? Perhaps maybe my co-presenters
They say xenophobia, so I think it's however you want to read the question. They weren't clear on that one.
Okay, because I don't recall incidences of xenophobic violence during the COVID-19 period, but then that's why I'm asking for clarity on that one. Perhaps maybe Kuda or Chris would be able to speak to that one.
Yeah, Chris.
Unless if maybe the question Kuda can be refined.
Yeah, I think if the question can be refined, of course, you have in the general discourse, you could say maybe there are xenophobic statements that are uttered during the at the height of the COVID-19 lockdowns and so on. But in terms of attacks on foreign nationals during that period, I also at a loss, unless the question is clarified.
And anyone else, Sue or
yeah,
I don't feel I'm in a position really to comment on that.
I'm also not aware of any sort of what we would actually call COVID-related xenophobia, but we are aware perhaps of how, in terms of policy, migrants and asylum seekers and refugees were not necessarily kind of incorporated into some of the sort of social relief that locals or South Africans were receiving. I do understand that one of the grants for sort of people who are not necessarily employed, which I think was an average, I stand to be corrected, or 300 rand or something per month in the initially tabled in the sort of first 3 months or so of lockdown, which people were entitled to receive. I understand that there was sort of a court case that was taken up, I think, through, I think it was Scalabrini, to try to have sort of my asylum seekers and refugees also incorporated in that scheme. And I do understand that that case was won. So there are sort of specters of discrimination in terms of who's conceptualized as, you know, worthy, as it were, of receiving relief, COVID-19 related relief. Perhaps also the border, the sort of erection of a fence at the border between Zimbabwe and South Africa, that kind of also cost a couple of the state a couple of millions to put up. Again, I'm also not necessarily privy to whether that was, you know, structurally, whether that was ever completed or not, but there were those kinds of proposals on the table, that also raised the alarm, I think, for certain people who perhaps see this as a stigmatization or of particular bodies as perhaps being a threat to bring the virus to South Africa, which is very counterintuitive, seeing as it is that South Africa is sort of a metro kind of hub for the entire continent, and people were flying in from different places during the early phases. And that is also how, through different forms of travel that are not necessarily cross-border, that is how also how the COVID-19 sort of spread or came to the country. It is a very, again, sort of a race, again, going back to perhaps the organizing principle, sort of you racialize bodies in such a way that you don't necessarily see where perhaps you could be channeling certain efforts because of a particular perspective of particular individuals. And that is as far as the COVID-19 xenophobia interaction goes, in my understanding.
Yeah, it strikes me that certainly it's partly phased, in the sense that early on, one saw people of Chinese origin being implicated as being carriers of or something, and then that as this thing became truly globalized rather than localized, that story changes. So it's a very evolving. It may be that dimension is what the question speaks to. Here's another question from Mercy Gitonga. To what extent does xenophobia vary across different socioeconomic groups across South Africa? Is it less prominent among skilled workers and higher socioeconomic groups? I don't know who wants to tackle that one.
Maybe I can go first. I think with regards to that question, it does vary, yes, across different socioeconomic class groups. And that's why I mentioned that in some cases, it's the situation where certain non-state actors have taken that particular responsibility to sort of police immigrants, to say maybe property owners might then be the ones that say you cannot rent an apartment without perhaps an identity document or a bank statement with 3 months of income as proof, or your payslip and so on. So that'll be the socioeconomic level. And then as you go to the much lower socioeconomic classes, then you have sometimes incidences that even lead to the violence itself. So I would say it does vary. And in some cases, we have heard, I think one of the media moguls who owns a very prominent newspaper, the Mail Guardian, once took it upon himself, because he is originally from Zimbabwe, to write his own sort of reflection on the level to which it also occurs to him across the boardrooms where he controls stakes and sort of like discusses very important business, that at his level, at board discussion level, he would actually be experiencing certain attitudes that show that he is not, or that he is, or attitudes of othering. And he wrote quite at length at how that really affected him, and that it was not just the man on the street in the poor informal settlements who was finding the heat, but also at that level as even a shareholder of a big newspaper company. So I'll stop there.
Would anyone... Sorry.
Well, I just want to, of course, mention Herman Mashaba, who was, of course, the first person to use Put South Africa First hashtag. I mean, he achieved controversy, should we say, as mayor of Johannesburg. And the tweet that I'm making particular reference to, that he launched in April of this year, implied in the accompanying video various crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. So, I mean, he's a leading South African businessman. Another person with Action South Africa who has retweeted the Put South Africa First is, of course, Mario Kumala, who is the founder of, as I say, South Africa First. A range of xenophobic attitudes that Chris elaborated with considerable skill exist within different classes of South African society.
Can I ask then a question by Verena, who wants to know if the speakers could touch on the gender dimensions of this discrimination. Is one gender disproportionately affected? Is the type of violence and discrimination different towards different genders? Could I ask, if I turn to you, Sue, first to address
that? I don't have enough data on that. I wouldn't want to hazard a guess. I'm going to defer to colleagues.
Okay. Chris, do you have a comment on that particular aspect?
I would defer to Kuda, but just to generally say that at least if you consider the discrimination and also the violence against foreign nationals in the context, or rather from the perspective of one of the approaches that I referred to, particularly the decolonial approach, then you would broadly argue that whatever negative experiences that foreign nationals go through or suffer, they are more pronounced for women than they are for men. So they suffer, I would say, maybe twice or four times than the men would suffer. And here I'm basically kind of borrowing on my research on informal cross-border trade, and the fact that again, it's not only about South Africa, it's generally across the I would even venture to say across the African continent, where you find these traders crossing between countries, and female traders are more vulnerable to a wide variety of injustices and also negative practices done on them than men. So it's more pronounced for females in general than it is for men.
Yeah. Thank you. Kuda, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, maybe let me start with the socioeconomic one. Like, I don't think that it's also as clear cut as perhaps, obviously, perhaps we can talk about how socioeconomic status kind of provides a buffer for certain people to, particularly maybe middle class, going up to afford perhaps to stay in particular residential areas where space, housing, accommodation, all of that are not necessarily as politicized. So that in some ways maybe offers some kind of a protection. So, but at the same time, those who are also staying in some of these communities then might also protect themselves or create certain buffers by maybe learning particular languages or learning the local languages by necessity to also kind of be part of the fabric of those communities that they're in. And in terms of gender, I'm also not necessarily sort of a gender analyst or an expert, but from the work that I've done around looking at some of the discourses around trafficking in persons, particularly women and children, and also building on the work that colleagues have also done at the center, one of the things we know is that there are sort of subtle kind of ways in which different sort of forms of, I think in the work that Belinda Dodson did, looking at some of the ways in which there's implicit gender bias towards men, particularly in policies, for example, we find that when we have a policy that's developmental or sort of driven by a migration and development agenda that only sort of recognizes or sees high skills or highly skilled people as the most preferred, you're naturally turning also into a sort of, inherently turning into a sort of masculine or patriarchal, as it were, sort of forms of governance, because what you're doing there is looking at the profile, as she does in her work, of people or women from the region who are not necessarily educated, who don't necessarily have as many networks, who then have to move to South Africa to find work, over and above then become undocumented. You're basically sort of putting them at the kind of sharp end of structural violence. So perhaps that is the one kind of gendered way we can look at it. The other way is how trafficking policies or sort of also take away the agency of women by sort of who are working in areas such as sex work by sort of suggesting that they are victims. And this is again scholarship that's been done by scholars such as Palmery and Chandra Good at the ISS, who have looked at how some of these moral panics around issues such as trafficking and how they are attached to particular bodies, particularly women and children, might undermine some of the ways that they seek to assert their own autonomy and volition in terms of their migration journeys and experiences. So perhaps without crudely referring to that as xenophobia, we can think about how the state becomes complicit as well in marking particular bodies as without agency in very expedient ways that that also kind of work hand in hand with securitization, because the more you're able to show that these women cannot move of their own volition into a trade such as sex work, then I think the more you are able to also just simply police them as you please and also undermine their aspirations.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask Nedson, would you like to come in?
Yes, could I just refer also the question to the issues of maternal health? I thought Kuda was going to touch on that. There are quite a number of dissertations that have looked at discrimination, even amongst Somali women, where there was female genital mutilation. And in some cases, you'd find healthcare workers sort of being at the forefront of denying certain access or ill treatment of pregnant women when they go and give birth in some of those hospitals. So maybe that's an area to look at. There's quite a lot of theses online from Wits University that one can look at. Thank
you. Great. I wanted to jump in with my own question, which is really one of about the overhang of history on this, and partly given that we've discussed this as in a regional context, does the past in the form of colonialism, the distinctive and different forms of colonialism in the region, I'm thinking of the Lusophone versus the Anglophone, does that change some of the dynamics that when it comes to xenophobia, as it presents itself in Angola, Mozambique, does that change anything, or was that is that a superficial way of understanding the impact of the past on the present when it comes to this particular issue? It might be a question for Chris. I throw it open to any of you who want to take a stab at it.
I'll go first. I think I did allude to that, particularly when I was borrowing on definition of xenophobia is racism by Grosvogel. And you do see, of course, nuanced reactions towards foreign nationals in different countries. So that there's a sense in which, of course, not only history itself, but the time it has taken from the time colonialism ended in each country to the present. So that maybe the further back you go, the more sort of receptive hosts may be of foreign nationals. You could argue it in that way. But also, of course, the colonial experience itself has a telling effect on the way the nationals will treat foreign nationals. And that's why you find, for example, Crash and Ramachandran would even argue to say there's a sense in which when you look at a country like South Africa, you could say violence is generalized. And because of that, that also has an effect on the way in which the locals will respond to foreign nationals. And it explains maybe the extent to which they go in expressing their aggression towards foreign nationals. But if you look at other countries, for example, Zimbabwe, with all its challenges, still, there's a sense in which you can't say there's a generalized level of violence. And so the way they will react to foreign nationals will be totally different from the way the South Africans will.
I don't know if anyone else wants to jump in, or should we leave that?
Yeah, if I may. For me, it's, I think I'm more interested in that kind of historical discussion in terms of how you find a sort of particular form of sort of colonialism that creates South Africa as sort of this, like this future to be occupied by certain people, right? And I think we see that as well in the political discourses of sort of Jacob Zuma the other time talking about how South Africa is not necessarily just like any other, can't exactly remember the exact allusion, but making reference to Malawi, right? And laughing it off to say, this is South Africa, this is not Malawi. So whatever, you know, whatever the meaning is.
Jacob Zuma said that, yes, I remember that. Yeah.
He did say that at some point in his, during his tenure. And it does tell you a lot about sort of the special temporal construction, if you could call it that, of South Africa is this, is a sort of a figment or an imagination, right? And that imagination has, I think, really then governs how people see who comes and who doesn't. I think in terms of history, one can also think about the ways in which certain nationals are perhaps perceived as part of the collective national identity by drawing on particular aspects of history that perhaps certain cadres of the ANC or Umkhonto overseas with the military wing were harbored in certain countries and et cetera, et cetera. And as much as that narrative is not necessarily, hasn't necessarily sort of led perhaps to any much sympathy as it were, or we can't really trace whether or not, but one could argue that some of those narratives also create certain hierarchies of who perhaps belongs in this particular country and who doesn't necessarily belong, or at the very least, who can have a particular stake or a claim to say, I shouldn't be attacked because you know, we were the ones who took care of your people during this time. So what you're basically doing is you're including certain groups, but at the same time, you also risk excluding those who might not necessarily fit in that historical narrative. Perhaps for me, that's where the historical issues become somewhat compelling. And then maybe lastly, it's maybe tied perhaps to the broader geopolitics of the region, where I once spoke to someone from the ILO who mentioned that in one of the meetings that they were having at the SADC level, someone said, we don't really, you know, one of the sort of South African officials said that we're not really so much fazed by, you know, Zimbabweans working in the, you know, catering industry or whatever. You know, those are our brothers, but we are worried about, there are certain groups that come, for example, from the north. So you start to see how history and geography kind of play out into like a sort of contemporary narrative of belonging. And I think that's really an interesting, I think an interesting issue to look at, if one would like to.
We have two more questions I wanted us to tackle. One of them relates to a comment, Kuda, you just made, was Belinda was asking about the role of MK veterans in expressing or amplifying xenophobic views. And if anyone has anything to comment, any comments on that particular dimension. And then the other question is the response of other countries, governments in the region or beyond, to acts of xenophobia in South Africa, and how that's affected relationships and the like. So MK first. I don't know if anyone wants to speak to the tackle the question of the veterans and their role in this discourse. Yeah, go ahead. So you're muted at the moment.
I think that just taking it on a broader landscape, the role of MK veterans in amplifying xenophobic views, in fact, reflects contradictory attitudes within, if you like, the ANC family. That there is idealizational views that South Africa should have that liberal progressive image embedded in its constitution, in its progressive values, enshrined in the Bill of Rights, and that it should allow for that free settlement refugee policy and welcome African brothers in very much a pan-African attitude. But what we have certainly seen in recent years is a marked erosion of pan-Africanism. And there have been statements that, in fact, rather than we shouldn't see ideas of incarceration or criminalizing migrants, that other ANC may feel, well, we survived in the camps in exile, that we have now returned and we need to deal with the colonialism of a special type in our own country. So I think that there are a multiplicity of conflicting views within the ANC, but I would agree with other speakers that there has been a disturbing shift to securitization the South African state sovereignty and the MK as veterans with a militarized idea of continuing that struggle, I think it plays into sub-themes and narratives within the political discourse.
Thank you. Does anyone else want to comment on that particular?
Yeah, just in addition to what Sue has said, I think there's also the notion, besides securitization, is the notion of politicization of migration. And here I'm basically speaking to issues of populism.
Yeah.
You know, using migration as and you have to look at this in the context of the cycle of elections that happen in the country. So this year particularly, we have local government elections coming up, and one would think that if you look at the trends on social media and also the MK, their activity starting from last year, you tend to think that it's basically strategizing to say we have local government elections coming. I would even maybe dare say that even the former mayor of Johannesburg forming a political party and kind of anchoring on the issue of getting rid of, you know, illegal foreigners in the country is basically a populist attempt to garner support and also to be able to gain votes during the elections that are forthcoming. Then the other question was about the reaction in the region, with particular reference to the not the most recent, but at least the 2019 attacks. I think that's the first time when we kind of saw a defined response from the diplomatic corps in South Africa. So we had diplomats from other African countries. They basically grouped up together and demanded audience from the Department of International Relations, which they had, and of course they expressed their displeasure with that. But we also had a number of countries in the region. I remember Zambia was supposed to have the Zambian national soccer team or football team was supposed to have a match with the South African team, and the Zambian government said they would not allow their team to come and play football because of those attacks. I think there was another country, it might have been Malawi, I can't quite remember. So you have this at the national or government level, you have these diplomats and also a government saying they're not going to play football or soccer because of the attacks. But within the countries in the region, also in those particular attacks, so I think it was 2019, we had a number of matches organized, and even actually South African interest in terms of chain stores that operate in the region, where the nationals of those countries went and closed up those chain stores and did not allow them to operate, just to express their displeasure with what was happening. So those were some of the reactions that we saw in the 2019 attacks.
Great, thank you. Sue, do you want
to? And of course, in earlier attacks on foreign workers within informal settlements and within the townships, there was, of course, the well-known Nigerian outrage that there really was an explosion of nationalism and a sense of patriotism within Nigeria, with all sorts of tropes of South Africa in turn being identified as lazy and unreliable. There were attacks on South African business, demands for compensation. So just to respond to that earlier question.
And one, if I can ask the speakers, because I know it's particularly in South Africa, it's getting late, so I don't want to cut into your dinner and what have you. But just one last question from Francis Musoni at the University of Kentucky about the role of the mainstream media. Has it acted to mitigate anti-foreigner sentiments or attitudes amongst ordinary South African citizens? If anyone could take that on.
If I could just give a comparison with South African mainstream media, it's the new media of social media is really the news platform, because legacy media has very limited circulation in comparison to social media and its reach. If you think of the stats of the Star, biggest has 75,000, the Argus 27,000, Cape Times 29,000. It's appealing to a very small constituency of middle-class educated voters, yes, but that is, of course, the English language print media, but other language print medias also have, in terms of print media, limited print runs in terms of social media use reach. I think you can divide media in South Africa between state-controlled and influenced media and independent media, but I would also say that it's not as bad as the Wild West of Facebook or of Twitter or Instagram, but there have been multiple instances of questionable statements and implicit or sliding towards more explicit antagonism towards towards migrants and refugees. The popular discourse, the politicians' discourse, I think, which of course is reported, is also part of this. And you have instances of xenophobic statements, but within a context of a highly polarized and diverse and divisive use of language towards others, be they journalists, be they political opponents. And I do think that in discussion that we should also bear in context, that broader context of South African society. I don't wish to minimize the importance of looking at the manifestations and understandings of xenophobia, but I do think it has to be understood particularly in the South African context.
Yeah, if I could also just add perhaps my own, my observations really lately have been perhaps how certain issues in the media are left open-ended. So if a politician says something that's problematic, then, you listen to it, then you go make yourself a cup of tea when, hoping that once that statement is done, someone is going to step in and say, let's clear the air. This is where we need to substantiate fact from myth. I don't think that the South African media kind of are doing as much of that at this particular moment. One example in point is, I think there was a lot of fury around the Prophet Bushiri, who's a very prominent, charismatic Pentecostal prophet who had his own sort of tax issues, and managed to skip bail from the country to Malawi. And there were issues now being raised about, I remember watching like the Home Affairs minister being grilled, is this country safe? Are our borders safe? If there's people like this who can just do as they please and leave as and when they please, what's really happening? So, it's again some kind of moral panic around it. And also at certain points there was, one can also tell that this risks generalizing perceptions about migrants and who perhaps is doing this kind of, people saying if this kind of a person who's high profile can just escape, God knows what's happening, with our borders, so it becomes a very criminalization, securitization issue of migration, as opposed to sort of addressing the person in question, right? Mm-hmm. I'm Zimbabwean. I wasn't there when he was doing what he was doing in his church, right? So it's all of those, and then when that kind of portfolio meeting is done, no one really steps up to say, okay, let's disentangle some of these issues. Which ones of these concerns are substantiated, which ones are not? So things are sort of left floating in the imaginary, anyone can do what they please with that kind of discourse.
Great. I'm going to take that as the penultimate statement on this topic. If Nedson, do you have something else that you would like to say in regards to this, a sort of summary, and then I'll turn to Chris to wrap it up for us tonight.
Not really. I think I was also trying to answer a question about insurgents and what can be done. And I think the trucking industry is one where there have been serious attacks on truck drivers and burning of trucks. And I think the answer, I typed it up to say there might be, there should always be in future, early warning signs must be detected and there must be relevant or appropriate policing related to that. But at the same time, there should always be early enough dialogue between the perpetrators of that particular violence, because usually some of them come out with a face and say, this is what we stand for. Just like Belinda Dodson's question around the MK veterans, that they said their own grievances are not being looked into, and therefore they decided to partner with the trucking company, with the truck drivers groups, and then started driving out foreign traders in Durban. And so there's need for that dialogue to always be there, rather than for politicians to come at the end and simply say, we are looking into it, because in the end, it always resurfaces in a different town or in a different location within the country. So there's that need for early warning signs to be obeyed and observed, and tactful operations be put into policing that, so that future things do not come in and become a problem for the country. Thank you.
Sorry, let me ask Sue to, and then Chris, let me to bring us to finality here.
I'd just like to say that in terms of moving forward, I think there needs to be a dramatic improvement from the government's response and the regulatory environment to deal with manifestations of xenophobia in terms of dealing with hate speech, discrimination, incitement to violence, and actually to put into action its national plan to combat racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia and related intolerance. And I think that there is, of course, a very active debate going on in South Africa at the moment about how to about the media regulatory environment, which also does need to be addressed. So this is part of an ongoing discussion. So just want to briefly say that.
So, Chris, if you want to.
Yes, maybe just to point out also with regards to especially the legacy media and following the 2019 attacks, at least we did see a positive response from government. I think then Minister Gigaba actually came up even with an award for maybe most, prominent or most active foreign national. There was an award that was prepared for, made for a foreign national that makes the most contribution or something like that. But apart from that, we did at least see some kind of a shift in some of these broadcast stations, for example, where they would make statements to say xenophobia is not good and basically dissuading people from engaging in xenophobia and promoting this "We Are One Africa." And that also leads me to maybe my final statement to say, in the broader context of migration, I think xenophobia is a problem for the whole continent, particularly, and if you look back a few weeks ago, 1st January, when the continent launched the African Continental Free Trade Area, basically trying to make one market of the continent, and free movement of persons is one of the key tenets of that, and speaks to the Agenda 2063 to say there should be movement of labor, there should be movement of persons that are engaged in trade. So xenophobia is kind of a negative or antithesis of the aim of continental integration. And so for policymakers, I think ways should be found to deal with this problem and make sure that they work towards achieving the goals which they voluntarily, subscribe to in seeking to integrate the continent and also the regions in the continent.
Thank you very much. I really very much appreciate all of you to have taken the time to join us, and of course our audience as well, and their questions. It's one of those proverbial things that we would say we've scratched the surface, but I think we've actually done something more than scratch the surface. We've actually dug a bit deep. I got my fingernails into this one a little bit, and it's a real we've heard it from a range of experts who really have done a wonderful job of sharing their time and their knowledge on this research topic with us. So thank you very much. Thanks to Chris, Kudu, Nedson, and Sue. And the broadcast is recorded, so it can be recorded again, and we'll have links with their respective emails and the like. So thank you, and good evening to everyone.
Thanks. Thank you so much, everyone. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.